This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, we consider the nuclear issues of Hurricane Sandy with Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds, and recall a time when Democrats opposed illegal wars and bombing campaigns with the late George McGovern. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and this is 5 o'clock shadow. Today, Hurricane Sandy is seeking landfall, but the supermassive weather system has already caused major flooding along the Atlantic coast, exacerbated by the high tides induced by the current full moon. The prospects for flooding and potential power outages pose serious hazards for dozens of American atomic plants east of the Mississippi. Nuclear expert Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds Energy Education considered these hazards overnight, along with the ongoing Pacific radiation leakage at Fukushima, in a conversation with colleagues at Fairwinds.com. According to Gunderson, nuclear stations could endure flooding, but not the loss of external electricity from regional power grids.
Now, this hurricane is huge. And it's occurring at the full moon, which means that tides are high. But the real issue is likely to be the storm surge, which is essentially the extra height in the center of the hurricane as the water comes in, and the waves. And then, but more importantly, will be the flooding, the inland flooding. The waves and the storm surge will likely do a lot of destruction on the New Jersey coast, likely not do too much damage to the power plants. My expectation is that it will be flooding related and high wind related.
But these power plants should be ready for that.
You know, the plant can withstand relatively high winds, but the transmission grid can't. That's all those transmission towers that are all over the states. So what's likely to happen is that the power lines will go down and the plant will suffer what we call loss of offsite power. And that's what happened at Fukushima Daiichi. The offsite power was eliminated. At that point, The plant, if it's operating, the plant should will automatically scram because it's got no place to send its power.
Now, when you say scram, that means to shut down the reactor?
The control rods are going real quickly, and the nuclear chain reaction will stop. The plant needs to drop its power immediately because there's no wire at the other end to send it anywhere if the offsite power is lost. So what happens next, though, is that the diesel generators have got to turn on because there's no other alternative source of power. Some of these plants have two diesels, and some of these plants have three diesels, and they're designed so if one of the diesels fails, they can still get by.
You've talked before about loss of offsite power. I guess, can you just explain why offsite power is needed on the nuclear plant?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine, but a nuclear plant needs power to generate power. It's got ancillary systems that have to run off of power. And so as it sends power out to the grid, it also sends some of that power back into itself to run. Almost 5% of the nuclear electricity is used to run the pumps that make the electricity. So when offsite power is lost, the plant is forced to dramatically reduce power real quickly, and then it still needs to be cooled. You know, you'll hear in the next 2 days that we've shut down the plant, we've safely shut down the plant. What that means is they've stopped the chain reaction, but what Fukushima taught us was that doesn't stop the decay heat. There's still as much as 5% of the power from the power plant that doesn't go away when the plant shuts down. And for that, you need the diesels to keep the plant cool.
So if and when the plant loses off-site power, the diesels kick in to keep the plant cool, and those diesels fire up, no problem.
Well, when I was at Northeast Utilities back in the 70s. We had a hurricane come in, and then we lost offsite power. The plant scrammed, and we had two alternative ways of producing power, and one of them didn't work. So we were down to one diesel, and we sat for 6 hours and on just one diesel until the offsite power was restored and we could get power into the plant to help with the cooling. The plant's designed to run on one, so of course the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would say everything was safe and sound. But I'll tell you, as the plant operator, the people running the plant, it's a little bit of a nervous time to realize that you're on your last fallback. You just hope that the last fallback keeps running.
What should plant operators and managers in these companies be doing in preparation for Hurricane Sandy?
It would be better if the plants shut down before they lost the offsite power. As a hurricane comes in, they'll know that pretty soon there's going to be high winds, and while the plant itself may withstand the high winds, the transmission won't. So it would be better if the operators, instead of waiting for the power to fail, shut the power plant down ahead of time. And the reason for that is that when a plant scrams, that's a sudden shutdown, that's a pretty severe jolt to the systems, and it's a challenge to the safety systems. Whereas if the operators can bring it down slowly over 5, 6, 7 hours ahead of time, that's less of a challenge. Sort of the difference between slamming on the brakes and coming to a gradual halt. It's less stressful for the power plants. So I'm hoping that there's 26 power plants in the East Coast that are in the area where Sandy is likely to hit. And hopefully when as the storm track becomes better defined, the plants that are most subject to it, likely New Jersey and Pennsylvania, preventatively shut down. And that would, of course, minimize the impact, the jarring to the nuclear reactor and its safety systems.
So in the event of a loss of offsite power, you know, we're talking about the diesels, and it's quite possible they'll be down to relying on their last diesel to keep the plant cool. And that keeps the reactor cool. From Fukushima, though, we know that the fuel pool needs to stay cool as well. How do the fuel pools factor into this?
The nuclear reactors are not designed to cool the fuel pool off the diesels. And the theory has been that, well, pretty quickly we'll get power back and we'll be able to cool the nuclear fuel. So the reason they didn't cool the fuel pool with the diesels is because those pumps require a lot of power and you need bigger diesels. So no one wanted to buy bigger diesels, so they basically have penciled the problem away and said that, well, we don't need those diesels for 6, 8, 10 hours, so therefore we'll figure out a way of cooling the fuel pool even though we've lost offsite power. There's a problem. There's a lot of problems there, as we learned at Fukushima. The fuel pools, especially this time of year, some of these plants are recently refueled, and they have hot fuel in their fuel pools. The fuel pool churns off an enormous amount of moisture, even in the best of circumstances. And as it gets hot, if the diesels fail and the pumps aren't on, the water will heat up several degrees an hour and start throwing off more and more and more moisture. Well, the buildings are not designed to handle high humidity. So in addition to the fact that the fuel pool's warming up, you're throwing an enormous amount of humidity up into the air as well. And the last thing is this was a study done by Dave Lockmont back in the 90s. He discovered that the fuel pool liner seams are not really designed to approach boiling water, and in fact the stainless steel liners in the fuel pool may unzip if the water gets too hot. So there's a lot of problems with allowing a fuel pool to overheat, and yet we've deliberately built our nuclear plants so that the only fallback in the event the diesels turn on is to let the fuel pools begin to get warmer.
And how long would it take for a fuel pool to boil?
Well, it takes, depends on how much fuel is in the pool. All these pools are full. But more importantly, some of those reactors, those 26, have recently refueled. So they have hot nuclear fuel in the fuel pools. And in that case, it's a couple of days. Mm-hmm.
So Arnie, Hurricane Sandy, what's the bottom line? What should people be thinking?
Well, it's a big storm, and it is likely that there'll be loss of offsite power for quite a few of these 26 nuclear plants that are that are involved. And that means the diesels hopefully will all turn on, and at least one of them really must turn on in order to safely get through this. The chances of a diesel failing are less than 1 in 100. So if you have two diesels, it's 1 in 100 times 1 in 100, or 1 in 10,000 possibility of both diesels failing. That's not remote, but it's not I got a head for the hills today kind of a problem. We need to keep track of what plants are experiencing loss of offsite power, and hopefully management and the NRC is forcing these plants to preventatively shut down ahead of it. It's just less stressful on the power plant.
Arnie, thanks for that update on the hurricane. Now, a quick change of topic. I know you received quite a few emails last week, people concerned that there may be a fuel pool fire in Unit 4. Can you tell me just a bit about that?
Yeah, we were inundated by phone calls from as far away as Peru and emails from all around the world. About what turned out to be a hoax. Someone on the internet misinterpreted a bunch of data. And then other people on the internet started to take old Reuters stories from a year and a half ago and change the date and put these Reuters stories up. But it was a hoax, and Fairwinds was, we were constantly talking to reporters and people who called in, as well as trying to respond to some of the emails. This is a case where the internet, while it's wonderful for access, provided just awful data.
You expressed that you thought that this hoax drew attention away from a bigger piece of news coming out of Japan right now.
You know, there really was an important story coming out of Japan this week. And that was this report from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute that talked about how much radiation is in the Pacific, and how it's not decreasing as they might have thought it would. There's a world-class organization based on Cape Cod called Woods Hole, and they study the ocean. They just came back from the coast of Japan. And they found that the benthic organisms at the bottom of the ocean, benthic means the bottom-dwelling organisms at the on the ocean floor, are not seeing a decline in the amount of radiation that they're carrying. Now, they were very surprised. They had thought that the Fukushima accident occurred a year and a half ago, and they could go back now, and they begin to see a decline. So the message is that the fish in the Pacific near Japan are still contaminated, especially the ones that feed on the bottom of the water. But the other message is that Woods Hole was surprised that it's not going down. Now, they reached the conclusion the reason it's not going down is because Fukushima Daiichi is still leaking into the ocean. So that even though the blast into the atmosphere essentially was 95% of it was done by April of 2011, the end of April 2011, that we're still seeing the plant leaking into the ocean. Now Tokyo Electric is building a wall along the coast. It's going to be 100 feet deep. It's not an up wall; it's a down wall. To prevent leakage into the ocean, but they're not going to be done until 2014. You know, we talked on the other podcast about the fact that the fuel pool is not going to be done until 2015. So Tokyo Electric has quite a few problems, and they can't spend enough money on any of them to get them solved in a quick way. So Woods Hole has come out and said that this is the certainly the worst release of radioactive material into the oceans ever in the history of nuclear power, and that it's not stopping. It's going to continue until these plants get rid of all the water that's in their basements.
And at this point, the damage is done.
And we'll continue to will continue to ooze radiation into the water. You know, the Tokyo Electric now is where is this coming from? It's probably a good question to ask. Where is this radiation coming from? It's the nuclear cores are melted down, and they have to be cooled. So you're pouring water across radioactive uranium and all of its daughter products. That water then is leaking into the basements of all the buildings on site. They're sucking that water back out of those basements and pumping it back in to cool the reactor again. But in the meantime, they have a giant filter on it, sort of like the Brita filter on your sink, but huge, that's trying to absorb some of this radiation. Those filters get so hot that they have to be put into a football field-sized place on the Fukushima site. They're running out of room to store the water. Within a year or two, there won't be any more room to store the water on site. So this problem is not going to go away tomorrow, and it's not going to go away even this year or next year. Likely, water management is the single biggest problem with Fukushima Daiichi. And assuming there's no earthquake, the biggest problem that that Tokyo Electric is going to be facing is water management. The water continues to come in from the groundwater into these basements, continues to get highly contaminated, continues to leak out into the ocean. And the filters they're trying to capture it on become so radioactive that they have to move them out to a football field on site. And that football field is rapidly becoming full. So what to do in the long term with all of this radioactive water is the biggest problem that Tokyo Electric has to face, assuming there's no earthquake that knocks down Unit 4.
So still leaking.
Still leaking, and will continue to leak for a long time to come.
Rain down.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. United Nations investigators in human rights and executions announced plans this week to determine the legality of President Barack Obama's kill lists and exponential expansion of killer drone strikes around the world. During recent debates, both Democrat Obama and Republican Mitt Romney agreed on the concept of remotely controlled homicide. Today, we reflect on a time when Democrats opposed illegal undeclared wars and mass murder of civilians, whether by drone strikes or by carpet bombing during the Vietnam War. One such peace-seeking Democrat was the late presidential candidate, Senator George McGovern, who spoke eloquently of peace and economic justice during his nomination acceptance speech 40 years ago at 2 a.m. on the 10th of July, 1972.
Chairwoman Burke, Senator Kennedy, Senator Eagleton, and my fellow citizens, I'm happy to join you for this benediction of our Friday sunrise service. I assume that everyone here is impressed with my control of this convention and that my choice for vice president was challenged by only 39 other nominees. But I think we learned from watching the Republicans 4 years ago as they selected their vice presidential nominee that it pays to take a little more time. And I can tell you that Eleanor is very grateful that the Oregon delegation at least kept her in the race with Martha Mitchell. So I congratulate you on your patience, and I pay my respects to those two superb presiding officers of this convention, Larry O'Brien and Yvonne Braithwaite Burke. And so tonight, I accept your nomination with a full and grateful heart. This afternoon, I crossed the wide Missouri to recommend a running mate of wide vision and deep compassion, Senator Tom Eagleton. I'm proud to have him at my side, and I'm proud to have been introduced a moment ago by one of the most eloquent and courageous voices in this land, Senator Ted Kennedy. My nomination is all the more precious in that is the gift of the most open political process in all of our political history. It is the sweet harvest of the work of tens of thousands of tireless volunteers, young and old alike, literally funded by hundreds of thousands of small contributors in every part of this nation. Those who lingered on the brink of despair only a short time ago have been brought into this campaign, heart, hand, head, and soul. And I have been the beneficiary of the most remarkable political organization in the history of this country. It is an organization that gives dramatic proof to the power of love and to a faith that can literally move mountains. As Yeats put it, count where man's glory most begins and ends, and say my glory was I had such friends. This is a people's nomination, and next January, we will restore the government to the people of this country. And I believe that American politics will never be quite the same again. We are entering a new period of important and hopeful change in America, a period comparable to those eras that unleashed such remarkable ferment in the period of Jefferson and Jackson and Roosevelt. I treasure this nomination, especially because it comes after vigorous competition with the ablest men and women our party has to offer. My old and treasured friend and the man from North Carolina who over the years has opened new vistas in education and public excellence, Terry Sanford. You're not conceding a single state to Richard Nixon. I should like to say to my friend Frank King that Ohio may have passed a few times in this convention, but Tom Eagleton and I are not going to pass Ohio. And I shall say to Governor Gilligan, Ohio is sometimes. He is the unwitting unifier and the fundamental issue of this national campaign. And all of us are going to help him redeem a pledge he made 10 years ago that next year you won't have Richard Nixon to kick around anymore. We have had our fury and our frustrations in these past months and at this convention. But frankly, I welcome the contrast with the smug and dull and empty event which will doubtless take place here in Miami next month. We chose this struggle, we reformed our party, and we let the people in. So we stand today not as a collection of backroom strategists, not as a tool of ITT or any other special interest. So let our opponents stand on the status quo while we seek to refresh the American spirit. Let the opposition collect their $10 million in secret money from the privileged few, and let us find 1 million ordinary Americans who will contribute $25 each to this campaign, a million-member club with members who will not expect special favors for themselves, but a better land for us all. And in the music of our children, we are told to everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven. And for America, the time has come at last. This is the time for truth, not falsehood. In a democratic nation, no one likes to say that his inspiration came from secret arrangements behind closed doors. But in a sense, that is how my candidacy began. I am here as your candidate tonight in large part because during four administrations of both parties, a terrible war has been charted behind closed doors. I want those doors opened, and I want that war closed. These pledges above all others. The doors of government will be opened and that war will be closed. Now, truth is a habit of integrity, not a strategy of politics. And if we nurture the habit of truth in this campaign, we will continue to be truthful once we are in the White House. Let us say to Americans, as Woodrow Wilson said in his first campaign of 1912, let me inside the government and I will tell you what is going on there. Wilson believed, and I believe, that the destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite. So let us give our country the chance to elect a government that will seek and speak the truth, for this is a time for the truth in the life of this country. And this is also a time not for death, but for life. In 1968, many Americans thought they were voting to bring our sons home from Vietnam in peace. And since then, 20,000 of our sons have come home in coffins. I have no secret plan for peace. I have a public plan. And as one whose heart has ached for the past 10 years over the agony of Vietnam, I will halt the senseless bombing of Indochina on inaugural day. There will be no more Asian children running ablaze from bombed-out schools. There will be no more talk of bombing the dikes or the cities of the North. And within 90 days of my inauguration, every American soldier and every American prisoner will be out of the jungle and out of their cells and back home in America where they belong. And then let us resolve that never again will we send the precious young blood of this country to die trying to prop up a corrupt military dictatorship abroad. This is also the time to turn away from excessive preoccupation overseas to the rebuilding of our own nation. America must be restored to her proper role in the world. But we can do that only through the recovery of confidence in ourselves. I believe that the greatest contribution America can now make to our fellow mortals is to heal our own great but very deeply troubled land. We must respond to that ancient command, physician, heal thyself. Now, it is necessary in an age of nuclear power and hostile forces that we be militarily strong. America must never become a second-rate nation. As one who has tasted the bitter fruits of our weakness before Pearl Harbor 1941, I give you my pledge that if I become the President of the United States, America will keep its defenses alert and fully sufficient to meet any danger. We will do that not only for ourselves, but for those who deserve and need the shield of our strength. Our old allies in Europe and elsewhere, including the people of Israel, who will always have our help to hold their promised land. And yet, I believe that every man and woman in this convention hall knows that for 30 years, we have been so absorbed with fear and danger from abroad that we have permitted our own house to fall into disarray. We must now show that peace and prosperity can exist side by side. Indeed, each now depends on the existence of the other. National strength includes the credibility of our system in the eyes of our own people, as well as the credibility of our deterrent in the eyes of others abroad. National security includes schools for our children, as well as silos for our missiles. It includes the health of our... So while protecting ourselves abroad, let us form a more perfect union here at home. And this is the time for that task. And we must also make this a time of justice and jobs for all our people. For more than 3.5 years, we have tolerated stagnation and a rising level of joblessness, with more than 5 million of our best workers unemployed at this very moment. Surely, this is the most false and wasteful economics of all. Our deep need is not for idleness, but for new housing and hospitals, for facilities to combat pollution and take us home from work, for better products able to compete on vigorous world markets. The highest single domestic priority of the next administration will be to ensure that every American able to work has a job to do. That job guarantee will and must depend upon a reinvigorated private economy, freed at last from the uncertainties and burdens of war. But it is our firm commitment that whatever employment the private sector does not provide, the federal government will either stimulate or provide itself. Whatever it takes, this country is going back to work. America cannot exist with most of our people working and paying taxes to support too many others mired in a demeaning and hopeless welfare mess. Therefore, we intend to begin by putting millions back to work, and after that is done, we will assure to those unable to work an income fully adequate to a decent life. Now, beyond this, a program to put America back to work demands that work be properly rewarded. That means the end of a system of economic controls in which labor is depressed, but prices and corporate profits run sky high. It means a system of national health insurance so that a worker can afford decent health care for himself and his family. It means real enforcement of the laws so that the drug racketeers are put behind bars and our streets are once again safe for our families. And above all, honest work must be rewarded by a fair and just tax system. The tax system today does not reward hard work, it penalizes it. Inherited or invested wealth frequently multiplies itself while paying no taxes at all, but wages on the assembly line or in farming the land, these hard-earned dollars are taxed to the very last penny. There is a depletion allowance for oil from the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. So let us close on this note. May God grant each one of us the wisdom to cherish this good land and to meet the great challenge that beckons us home. And now is the time to meet that challenge. Good night and Godspeed to you all.
Was in another lifetime, one of toil and blood, when blackness was a virtue, the road was full of mud. I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. And if I pass this way again, you can rest assured I'll always do my best for her, on that I give my word. In a world of steel-eyed death and men who are fighting to be warm, come in, she said, I'll give ya shelter from the storm. Not a word was spoke between us, there was a little risk involved. Everything up to that point had been left unresolved. Try imagining a place where it's always safe and warm. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. I was burned out from exhaustion, buried in the hail, poisoned in the bushes and blown out on the trail. Hunted like a crocodile, ravaged in the corn. Come in, she said, I'll give ya shelter from the storm. Suddenly I turned around and she was standing there, with silver bracelets on her wrists and flowers in her hair. She walked up to me so gracefully and took my crown of thorns. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. Now there's a wall between us, something that's been lost. I took too much for granted, I got my signals crossed. Just to think till it all began on an uneventful morn. come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. Well, the deputy walks on hard nails and the preacher rides a mount, but nothing really matters much, it's doom alone that counts. And the one-eyed undertaker, he blows a feudal horn. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. I've heard newborn babies wailing like a moaning dove, and old men with broken teeth stranded without love. Do I understand your question, man? Is it hopeless and forlorn? Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. In a little hilltop village, they gambled for my clothes. I bargained for salvation and she gave me a lethal dose. I offered up my innocence, I got repaid with scorn. Come in, she said, I'll give you a shelter from the storm. Well, I'm living in a foreign country, but I'm bound to cross the line. Beauty walks a razor's edge, someday I'll make it mine. If I could only turn back the clock to when God and her were born. Come in, she said, I'll give ya shelter from the storm.
And that concludes today's Sandy edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow, filed remotely with engineering by Michael G. Haskins, Reggie Johnson, and Kathy Davis, and produced with Thiago Brozo. We wish our listeners shelter from the storm and welcome your comments with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Some of them were dreamers. Some of them were fools, were making plans and thinking of the future with the energy of the innocent. They were gathering the tools they would need to make their journey back to nature. While the sand slipped through the opening and their hands reached for the golden moon, in their hearts they turned to each other's hearts for refuge. In the troubled years that came before the deluge, some of them pleasure, some of them knew pain, and for some of them it was only the moment that mattered. And on the brave and crazy wings of youth, they went flying around in the rain, and their feathers, once so fine, grew torn and tattered. Exchange love's bright and fragile glow for the glitter and the rouge. And in a moment they were swept before the deluge. Now let the music keep our spirits high. ocean reveal its secrets by and by. By and by, when the light that's lost within us reaches the sky. Some of them were angry at the way the earth was abused by the man who learned how to forge her beauty into power. And they struggled to protect her from them, only to be confused by the magnitude of her fury in the final hour. After the deluge, let the music keep our spirits high. Let the buildings keep our children.